Good morning. Let me go ahead and call the Mesa City Council study session of Thursday, May 17th to order. We have eight items on the agenda. The first is going to be review items for the May 21st regular council meeting. And I think we have two members excused. Let's excuse Vice Mayor Walters and Scott. Rex Griswold. Looking at Scott down there. Let's head to page one, just the citizen participation explanation, page two. We have a general plan amendment and resolution concerning some transit-oriented kind of development townhouses on Main Street. Also have a minor plan amendment on South Sossaman. Anything on page two, page three, another minor plan amendment. And I'll have a conflict on 6A, which is the Town Center Improvement District assessments. Still own some property in downtown. Mike, do you have similar? All right, so poll 6A is polled, and we'll just declare those on Monday. That puts us over on page four. I think 6B will also be conflicts for both Mike and I. Then we have a public hearing on development impact fees. Tom?
Is there anyone who's absent today who's going to be absent on Monday?
Mayor Kinsmorals, I believe both of them will be here on Monday.
I'm just concerned about 6B if there's two absences and a no. Two abstaining and a no, you might not get that.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm out of town and we'll be calling in on Monday.
Oh. All right. Okay. That's. Then we get into liquor license applications on page four. Those continue on page five. We get into contracts. I had a question on 9C, just what's the policy when you buy vehicles that have the service beds on them? It said 11-foot service body and a 9-foot service body. Do you ever switch those from the existing vehicle and keep the service body and just sell off the chassis? Or do you get more money by selling them as a complete unit?
Good morning, Mayor, Council. Actually, we do sometimes do that. It depends upon the application of the vehicle, where it's located and what RC, and the age of the vehicle, it's obviously, and the bed itself. Some of the vehicles that we're replacing are very, very old right now. Some are in excess of 12 years old. We had one replaced recently at 17 years old. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the condition of the bed at that time, it's almost as bad as a truck. In some cases, actually worse. So that's the reason that we're replacing.
Okay. Does it, if you sell them at auction with the bed on them, does it enhance the value enough, or have you ever
looked at that? You know, by the time that we sell a truck that's 12 years old, you know, on average, we're getting somewhere about $3,500 for it. Okay. So if we were to take the bed off, we'd get even less.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's... page five, page six. Nine E. Do I have a conflict on 9E? If I don't, I certainly have a couple questions on that one.
Mayor, it's hard to say because we could pick the product up or have the product delivered to our yard, so I know that you're associated with a firm that can probably haul that material, but I don't know if you do work for Sealmaster or not.
Have nothing with Sealmaster. My question, this is a sole source? They're the only ones that bid on the Glendale contract?
Well, there was two sets of plans picked up. You saw that. It could be sole source. It was a contract if somebody could bid to it, yes. But it happened to be sole source on this one here.
Okay, how long ago was the bid?
2005, I believe it was.
Okay. Have you inquired if there's other, was the spec Are there any other companies that make that spec material? Or was it a, it's not a proprietary spec, is it?
No, it's not. It's just a tire modified material. There's other products that can be used out there. Excuse me, and according to this, the Glendale spec, if you wanted to try a product, a company wanted to try a product that was comparable, they could give us, give the Glendale a 500 gallons to work with, try it, test it, and see if it's a product that we can use. So there's substitutions available, just that there was no bid at.
Okay. How long do you stay with a contract like that if it was bid in 2005?
I think.
Do you ever go out every other year, or is it good for 5 years, or how long does somebody lock in on a?
Mayor, I'm going to ask Ed Quedenson. I think this one here is one with 2 or 3 year extensions. I'm not sure.
I actually believe this is one with 4 1-year extensions possible.
So, all right. And when, how did you make the decision in-house that you would use another bid as opposed to bidding it in Mesa?
Well, one of the benefits of using co-op is the administrative cost of actually putting out a bid. In this case, we also we compared prices for the material that transportation wants to use, and we found we're in a really limited market on this product. And so we looked at the Glendale contract. We tried to see if there was anything else out there that would compare, and between our usage and Glendale's usage, we're being told we're getting a very good price.
Okay. All right. This one I know absolutely too much about, so I will stop right there. Scott?
I'd actually like to address 9F, which I think is yours also. I'm right. Looking at the traffic signal poles, mast arms, anchor bolts. Three different poles. Are these three different poles for different uses? These are for traffic signals, not the lights that we see downtown, just the lighting poles, just to clarify.
Mayor Scott Summer, this Councilman Summer, this is actually a combination of traffic signal poles and streetlight poles. There is some traffic signal poles that are Hunter Green. Those are just a tapered, I believe, tapered signal pole that are Hunter Green painted. Those are downtown, but they're not the streetlight poles for downtown.
How much more are those poles? So that's group 9 on this page 3?
Yes.
That's Hunter Green traffic poles and arms. And how much more are those costing? Do those cost the city per pole than the typical pole you would install in every other neighborhood?
I don't think we have that answer with us today, but we can get that for you.
Okay. And, well, without that information, just generally, does the Downtown Mesa Association pay the difference in installation and price between a normal pole and this Hunter Green special pole? Were you reimbursed by anybody? Or
Not that I'm aware of.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, just from my experience on these streetlight poles, that we have them painted or powder coated or whatever happens to be, typically adds about a $50 to $100 per pole to add that powder coating to it or paint it.
What about installation? Are they?
Installations are the same poles.
It's the same pole.
Yeah.
So it's really.
It's a small in the traffic pole. Signals example, it's just a tapered signal pole, just like a stick standard one, but it's painted.
Okay. Well, if the price of the installation is the same and the poles are generally the same price, that'd be all right, but I'd like to hear back and make sure that that's the case. If we're playing a lot more for these poles in one area, I'll have some problems with that. Okay, I'll leave it alone for now.
Okay. 9G was pulled for what reason? Okay. Does anybody else have questions on that one? No. Mike?
I have to ask myself.
No. You have a question?
Question on 9G. We have PD rep here, or someone from engineering, or Peter, you want to handle this? The combination for funding is from quality of life and from bonds. Do you know what the breakdown is on that?
Let's see.
Anthony.
Councilmember Whalen, the breakdown right now is we have a lit amount of the quality of life funds of $7.148 million. So the balance of that will be the...
$11 million or so.
Right.
Actually, $12 million when you figure the 10%.
Correct.
And those are, how many years are we going out on those bonds?
We're going to be, this is a, I think, a 16-month schedule. I'm not sure what the construction
says. 20.
The 20-year bonds. These are part of the bonds that were just sold last week.
Part of the construction cash flow is in this bond sale that you just recently approved.
And this was the 2000 bond election?
Correct.
Okay. This facility's been in the planning for 15 years at least. Commander?
Mayor, Councilmember Whalen, yes.
Okay. Do you have a drawing of the facility that we could look at?
We do.
Now, did you just happen to bring that with you?
Yes, they did. I avow I had no prior communications with the members
of
the panel.
And also, we'll put them up on the Alamo also, if I can maybe get a little assistance. We have a an aerial here which shows where the new facility will go, and we have the existing police administration building and the existing court building and the parking garage, and the new facility will go right in an existing parking lot between those buildings, and then we'll narrow it down. This is a composite photo showing the new building, and this is the new building, how it would look between the parking garage in the south and a court building on the north. And then I have a close-up view. Here's a close-up view of how the new building will look.
Is there a subfloor and then ground and one above, or how is it, what's the configuration?
We have a basement and then two floors, a ground floor and a second floor.
And is it built to where it could be expanded?
No, it is not.
Okay. What else did I want to ask on that? How will it tie to the court building through the, will there be a sub-level tie because the crime lab will stay in the basement of the court building?
Yeah, Councilmember Whalen, no, it is a separate building. There is no direct tie other than the surface connection.
Okay. And the parking facility that we've got currently is sufficient with moving the personnel out that it will accommodate future?
Yes, sir.
And what other question did I have? Oh, the amount of square feet.
We're just under 49,000 square feet, sir.
It's a nice looking facility. The brickwork ties it well to the rest of the complex, so I commend the architect on a nice looking facility. Questions? Anybody else? Thank you.
Anything else on page 6? Page 7? Introduction of ordinances, setting June 4th for several. That's page 7, page 8, zoning cases. 9, that's resolutions. 12B is the sale of property again by the city. All right. Page 10.
Mayor, if yes. I may, items 15E and 15F, the two cases associated with Lowe's, are being withdrawn.
All right, we have a letter in front of us from the attorney, and that is 15E and F. Okay. If they withdraw, I assume they have to start over when they refile. And
yes, Mayor, that's correct. If they want to proceed with this again, they will just start fresh over in the process.
Okay. And okay, it looks from the letter that I have in front of us that we are currently in the process of reconfiguring the site. How would that change anything as far as reapplying?
Mayor, I believe what they're looking at doing is adjusting the location of the council use permit, in particular on the site, and how they develop it so that they eliminate the possibility for the last protest to be within 150 feet. And affect that vote.
Okay, and how are we on the issue of the special use permit requiring being able to have a three-quarter vote? Was that decided?
Or? Yes, Mayor, Council, for the Council use permit, they did ask for interpretation of that by the zoning administrator. He reviewed it and went with our current application. That was appealed to the Board of Adjustment. They met on that on May 8th and upheld the zoning administrator's interpretation of the code. So Council use permits do indeed require the three-quarter vote if we get the legal protest.
Okay. All right, so we'll be seeing that later, probably. All right. Let's go ahead then and pull 15E and 15F, and can we get a notification out to the neighbors so they know? All right. Okay, page 11, more zoning cases. Continued on page 12. And 13, additional ones? Yes, John.
Mayor, again, on page 13, item 15M, it's the super regional shopping center proposal down at Haas and Elliott. We've also been working on a development agreement companion with this. We just finished that up yesterday. It's being signed, so it will be added to your agenda for Monday. Should get it in packets tomorrow.
Okay. And I believe that's the one that you made comments on with the hotel in there, Scott?
Right. I've had some discussion with that, too. It still remains conceptual on the north side. I still have some issues with the location of that hotel is close to the residential. The rest of that site plan looks fine to me. It's just the location of the hotel that I'm concerned about. So,
Mayor, one of the items that we do have in the development agreement is making it clear that there's no guarantee to future approval of the BIZ overlay to allow for anything other than the standard two-story height in the C2 zoning district. So they know that they don't have any guarantees of the taller facilities until they come back and get that specific review to help address that question.
Could we have a problem with 207 on that?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, let me ask if Donna's here. She's been working on the development agreement in this project.
Thank you.
And I'm hoping that it won't, well, let's see. I guess it could qualify for a freeway landmark monument sign, too, couldn't it? Okay.
Just trying to make my day.
Mayor, Councilman Summers, Donna Bronski from the Legal Department. No, we don't anticipate a 207 problem with this case, first because there aren't any rights being granted on the north part of the property, and second because we have a 207 waiver put right into the development agreement.
Okay.
Okay. All right, that's page 13, page 14. Okay. Anything that missed anyone wanted to talk about for Monday night's agenda? All right, let's go back to the study session items. Hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on traffic control devices at schools on arterial streets.
Mike? Commander Clore, is this your last meeting? Commander Clore is retiring after 30 years with the police department. Thank you for your service and good luck in what you're doing.
Very much.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Dan Clevenger, Assistant Transportation Director. With me is Renee Aim, Senior Transportation Engineer. Today we're going to give a brief presentation on the traffic controls at schools on arterial streets. About a year ago, Transportation implemented a number of traffic control changes in the reduced speed school zone on baseline at Rhodes. As requested by Council, we gave an update about 6 months ago on our successes in reducing driver speeds, and today is the one-year follow-up we promised. In addition, today we'll give a brief review of some objective criteria we've established with the Transportation Advisory Board for reduced speed school zones. And we'll also be giving some staff recommendations for traffic control devices in other reduced speed school zones in Mesa. It's kind of a mouthful. If I slip and call it dual speed limit zones, that's what I'm used to calling these things. It's the locations on the arterials where we previously had 45 miles per hour, and we have a reduced speed during the school day of 35 miles per hour. A little bit of background. The first installations of these, I'm going to just call them dual speed limit zones, we're at high schools only, and the reason for that, we had a large number of inexperienced drivers in the area, and There's a lot of activity or high activity levels in the morning, at lunch, and after school as well. In 2000, we reassessed the policy with the Transportation Advisory Board, and the decision was made to provide these reduced speed school zones on arterials for all junior high schools and elementary schools that front on arterial streets. In addition, charter schools and other non-traditional schools would be considered as well on a case-by-case basis. This next slide is just an aerial photo of the Rhodes campus. You can see Baseline Road at the bottom. The extent of this school zone goes from Pennington to Longmore. As I mentioned, this is one of the sites that was, the school zone was established in 2000. You'll recall not too long ago, September 2005, we had a fatal collision involving a Rhodes student on a bike at the intersection of Longmore and Baseline. That led to a lot of discussions with the school, parents, students, and council, and resulted in several traffic control changes, which were implemented in spring of 2006. Some of the traffic control changes implemented on Baseline near Rhodes were extending the hours for the 35-mile-per-hour speed limit. Initially, I believe it was 7:30 to 4, and I believe now it's 7 a.m. to 8 p.m., 13 hours during the day. We installed yellow flashing lights. Some of those lights were in conjunction with the driver's speed feedback signs. Those are the radar guns, the signs with the radar guns that show the approaching speed of the speed of an approaching vehicle. In addition, we installed more and larger school advanced warning signs. We installed reflective strips on those signs. They're bright fluorescent yellow-green strips that have the word school on them. They're attached to the post. And the last thing we did out there was at the end of the school zone, we erected a sign indicating that, just so folks would know that they could resume their 45-mile-per-hour speed. This next slide is just a couple photos of what the devices look like at Rhodes. That first one on the left there is the start of the school zone, so you'll see the static 35-mile-per-hour school sign with the solar panel and the flashers, which toggle. Below that is the driver speed feedback sign. The photo on the right is the static sign in the middle of the zone, just indicates the speed when flashing is 35. And so we've got those in each direction, so there's four total devices there. Next slide shows the typical school advanced warning sign. You can see the post. This picture doesn't really do it justice. It's kind of in the shade. They're really quite bold. The color of that reflective strip. On the right, that's the black on white end school zone sign. This next slide is a chart of the 85th percentile speeds we've gathered over time on Baseline at Rhodes. Just a reminder, the 85th percentile speed is a speed at or below which 85% of the traffic is traveling. Another way to say that is 15% of the drivers are traveling over that speed. The gray bars in the foreground indicate speed samples when the 35 mile per hour zone was in effect, and behind those in red are the speeds when the 45 mile per hour speed limit is in effect. So if you look at the first bars, those are in October 2005, the first set of bars, the gray and the red, the taller ones towards the left. You can see little variation in the prevailing speeds between the two limits. That indicates our 35-mile-per-hour zone wasn't working very well. There's only a 1.6-mile-per-hour difference, and I guess you'd expect a 10-mile-per-hour difference. The next five bars, gray and red, indicate speeds since we've implemented those traffic control changes. You can see in the gray bars, since we put up the flashers and the driver feedback signs and the other elements I mentioned, we've got a 6.5 to 7.5 mile per hour reduction in speed along there, which is pretty good. That corresponds to about a 14 to 16% lower speeds we're seeing out there under the 35 mile per hour condition. So I think we're still being real effective out there. You can see though, there's a trend. The speeds are starting to increase. The red bars are the 45 mile per hour. Those are increasing a little faster than the gray. So we're only up about 1 mile per hour, but there is a trend there that we're seeing, and we think that's just the drivers getting a little accustomed to the devices, so they're not so new anymore. And one way to put that in check, I think, is probably just a little bit of increased enforcement might be able to keep that in check or slow the increase anyway. A little history about the dual speed limits. Again, we started this program in 1987, and we just did the high schools. And then since 2000, I guess it was, when we expanded, we basically just been using our engineering judgment, as we often do, but also have gotten some direction from TAB and council for which schools might be appropriate, or at least which ones we should be looking at. In January of 2006, we had a request for the Sunridge Learning Center. I think that one came to council as well. I think there was some discussion. That was another one of those non-traditional schools. It's at Guadalupean Extension. And TAB asked us at that time, the Transportation Advisory Board, to develop some objective criteria, which basically the council had already kind of asked us to do that as well. So we got an early start because the TAB was looking for something a little sooner. So we put together some criteria and then went over those details at the March Transportation Advisory Board meeting. And the TAB did approve the staff's recommended criteria. I think you have a copy of those details in your packet. The criterion of scoring was built on a model that the state uses for their 15 mile per hour school crossing. So you assign point values for various conditions and you tally them up, and it's one way to be able to rank the schools against each other to see which ones may warrant some additional treatment. In October 2006, we applied the criteria for a second time at Sun Valley High School. This is a charter school at Southern and Lindsay. And again, like the Sunridge Learning Center, these schools don't have a lot of walking and biking traffic, so their characteristics are different than the public schools. So in this case, again, the Transportation Advisory Board upheld the staff recommendation to not install a reduced speed school zone. Like to cover real briefly, and again, you have this in your packet, these are the considerations or the criteria we use when trying to establish if a school warrants a reduced speed limit. We consider the traffic speeds, the traffic volumes, the number of student crossings on the arterial street adjacent to that school, the number of students walking and bicycling along that street as well, and the number of teen drivers. Of course, that only applies to the high schools.
Dan, I just wanted to comment on the objective criteria. I really appreciate the fact that accidents aren't included in that model. It has the FAA has always been referred to as a tombstone agency because they are responsive to accidents. And this seems to be a very preventative model, so let's not consider how many accidents. Rather, we're looking at speed and volume and potential. So I commend you on that.
Thank you. We appreciate that. In our scoring system, there's 100 points possible, and we've identified 50 points needed to justify a reduced speed school zone. The following slides are again, some of the considerations we made for what types of devices we'd install at selected schools or on a citywide basis. What I'm going to list on the next several slides is going to show the cost of the individual device or a pair of devices in the case of photo enforcement or flashers. We generally would do both approaches. And then a cost to implement that device or that effort on a citywide basis at all 14 of our reduced speed school zones. So this first one is the reflective strips that go on the signposts. Those are $89 a strip, including labor. There would be, if we move forward on this, there'd be about 160 strips necessary and a little over $14,000 in cost on a citywide basis. The next device is a relatively inexpensive one. It's the ahead plaque you see below the school advance speed sign, or the school advance warning sign, rather. Those are $65 for the plaque, and we would need 50 plaques, and it's a little over $3,200. These plaques are required under the federal manual on uniform traffic control device, but deemed optional by the state of Arizona. They have a supplement to the manual, so these are not required in the school, but in most states they would be required to be found below that particular sign. So the plaques would help us be consistent with other cities across the country and many in the valley who are putting these up, and just provides a little bit more information on to the driver that they're approaching a school zone. Next slide talks a little bit about the yellow flashers. To date, we have these in place at 3 of our 14 reduced speed school zones. They're at Rhodes Junior High School, Porter Elementary, which is on Lindsay south of Southern, and Longfellow Elementary, which is on Broadway west of Gilbert. We feel that the yellow flashers can be just as effective as the driver speed feedback signs, and they're about half the cost. If you look on there, you'll see $11,000 for a pair of flashers. That's really, each assembly has two flashers which toggle, so it's $11,000 is for the two sets of toggling flashers. We would need 21 and a half pairs for the remaining 11 school zones, and correct me if I'm wrong, Renee, but I think that that's because one of the flashers would be in the middle of a 15 mile per hour zone, so we wouldn't want to have any distraction within that zone. And if we implemented this at all of the remaining 11 sites, it would cost a little over $217,000. The next slide is the, in combination with the flashers, it's the driver speed feedback sign. The only place, again, we have these is at Rhodes Junior High School, and we've got two, one in each direction on baseline. Those cost a little over $25,000 for a pair, and we would need, if implementing citywide, we'd need 13 pairs plus 10 and a half pairs of the flashers for the remaining 13 school zones, and the cost for that is $428,000 on a citywide basis. The last item we considered, and this was done because we specifically had a request from council for speed on green, and particularly at Rhodes Junior High School, just for us to look into this particular option. You can see it's pretty expensive. It's approaching $11,000 to $12,000 to monitor each direction in front of a school, and total cost would be about $1.8 million a year annually to. On a citywide basis, if we were to implement photo enforcement at every one of the dual speed zones. Speed on green is certainly an option, as are red light cameras for this use, but we've already had a significant speed reduction, particularly on baseline at Rhodes Junior High, and I'm aware there's been some recent concerns about cost recovery in this program. One thing we do have available right now is the radar vans that could be deployed in any of these school zones, and obviously those can be moved around and rotated from site to site. If there's still interest in expanding the photo safety program, staff would suggest that we evaluate school and non-school sites to identify the best candidates in the city. So this led us to a few conclusions. A couple of schools kind of rose to the top when we applied the criteria and assigned some points. They were Fremont and Brimhall Junior High Schools. Fremont Junior High, if you're not familiar, is on Power Road south of Brown. Brimhall is on Southern west of Higley. Based on our results and our observations and all the considerations, we're suggesting potentially a higher degree of traffic control treatments at these two schools. Some of the other reasons for considering special treatment at these schools are the junior high school students are considerably more mobile than the elementary school students. They have less supervision around the schools. They're not old enough to drive or ride with other classmates. And generally, it's been our experience, 12 to 15-year-olds don't always make great decisions with regard to traffic safety, particularly when they're in groups. Both of these schools, Fremont and Brimhall Junior High School, have other schools in the immediate vicinity, so you get kind of extra bang for your buck if they were treated. Staff's already had previous contact with Mesa Public Schools. As a matter of fact, I had a call from their legal department soon after we did the changes on baseline at Longmore, and they requested to kind of get on a list for flashers. I know Councilmember Griswold has expressed some concerns about compliance on Power Road at Fremont as well. If council were to approve the staff recommendations for installing flashers, and I'll get to that in a second, we'd recommend getting some concurrence from Mesa Public Schools as a partner and make sure that these are sites they're good with, but we'd be happy to share our data with those folks. So the staff recommendation is to install reflective strips and the ahead plaques on a variety of signs. We'd have 160 signs getting reflective strips, 50 signs getting the ahead plaques, and those would go below the school advanced warning signs. At total cost of $17,550 for the signing component. We are recommending yellow flashers at two schools, total cost of $40,000. That would actually include eight flashers in two separate school zones. These are fairly long zones where drivers could get their speed up. So it'd be basically two sets of flashers two assemblies in each direction, so four flashers per school. And tentatively, again, we'd recommend those at Fremont and Brimhall based on feedback from Mesa Public Schools. We would also suggest these operate time frame 7:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. to match the current time frames on the sign. All of these schools already have these static signs that say it's 35 between 7:30 and 4, 45 at all other times. We'd also recommend a one-year evaluation on the effectiveness, and part of that reason is the other two sites we have flashers at right now are a little bit different. The one on Longfellow, which is on Broadway, is immediately before a 15-mile-per-hour zone, so we're getting quite a reduction in speed because of that zone. Those flashers were installed because we weren't getting real good compliance in the 15-mile-per-hour zone. The other set of yellow flashers is in front of Porter Elementary School on Lindsay, and that one doesn't currently have a lot of crossing activity, so we'd like to put some in at a location where there's lots of kids and more activity, just to as a test to see what kind of reductions we can get. So transportation has funding available in HERF operations to do this. If you tally that up, I think we're looking at approximately $57,500 for these. So be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. I assume you need post and insulation in addition, or is that worked into this price?
That works into the price.
So you can go out there and install one of those signs for $85, cement it in the ground, and put it on a post?
They're existing signs already, so you're just putting on the post.
Oh, all right. That makes more sense. Okay. Questions on this one, Tom?
Not sure it's a question. It's more of a couple of comments. It sounds like we're very accountant-wise here, measuring children's safety with dollars. And there has to be a certain component of that in any kind of public policy making. But I think this is, and so the question becomes, well, if you're doing this at Rhodes, why aren't you doing everything that you're doing at Rhodes elsewhere? And I think the chart that you showed, this council made the observation during the presentation on the Rhodes material that there was something really unusual about that street, because the speed, the 85 percentile speed during the 35 mile an hour zone time was almost as much as it was during the 45 mile an hour zone time, which was different than anywhere else from the traffic data that you gave us in the city. And so I think we all remember making that observation that nobody knows exactly what it is, nobody exactly knew why it was, but there was something different about driver behavior along baseline there than there was anywhere else in the city. And so I can support the recommendations that you're suggesting today, but I think it's important to explain why we're not rushing out, cost be damned if you would, even if we had the money, and putting all these things in at every junior high. And the fact is that the traffic, the driving patterns, the driving behaviors don't justify it at these other locations, because you don't have this first chart where the gray is almost as high as the black on this part. I think it was gray and red on the color slide, and that's the difference. This right here, this corner, this first column was just such an aberration that we had to do something. And I just think it's important to remember why we did what we did and not establish a uniform across-the-board policy. So,
Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, you're right on the money. That's exactly the situation.
Mike?
I'd like to see, just over the next couple of weeks, if we could, some status on Mountain View, what our speed studies are out there. Seems to be a lot, because of the proximity to the intersection of Lindsay, that we're getting a lot of crashes there also, and I'm just wondering if, of course, you'd have to do both Lindsay and Brown as far as flashers, but I'm just curious as to, is it a problem or is it just a perceived problem? Mm-hmm. You got it, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Mayor and council members, in Appendix D, we listed a number of the factors that we looked at when we were preparing this report. And Appendix D, the first page, number two, lists the traffic speeds, and we actually went out and did traffic speeds at all of these dual speed limit zones. And what we've just shown you in the chart is the 85th percentile speed during the 35 mile per hour period. And another really large graph in the office, I've got the speeds during the non-school hour times as well. But you can see that Mountain View on Lindsay, the highest speed direction, we measured 41 miles per hour as the 35th percentile. And on Brown Road, 37. And that's probably due to the fact that there are a lot of traffic signals in that area.
Okay.
The other part.
Renee, before you move on, Mayor, since we're looking at this, mm-hmm. I'd like to call attention to that 51 miles per hour speed on Chrisman at Desert Ridge High School. That was just for one direction, and the I think that was for southbound, which is mm-hmm. away from the school. Northbound wasn't quite as high. We're working with the police department to try to get some enforcement out there. I'd like to think it's a little bit of an aberration, but we're not certain, so that's one we're following up on. It was considerably higher than the others, kind of like what happened in front of Rhodes, but that's something we're following up on, see if we can get those speeds in check.
What was your recommended point total for when you would, was it over 80 points?
Mayor, Councilmember Whalen, it was 50 points out of a possible 100.
So really, most of our high schools would qualify under that recommendation.
Mayor, Councilmember Whalen, I think all of our high schools, and I think all, maybe with the exception of one, I don't recall, elementary school, mm-hmm. would qualify. What these are in place for right now is certainly new schools, but more, we were getting a lot of requests for the non-traditional schools. And in order to, staff didn't want to just say, no, you're not a public school, because that's not the issue. It's the characteristics of the school. And so we want to evaluate them on a basis that would have made them more equivalent to what we're already doing at the public schools. That makes sense.
Do you share this information with police traffic enforcement?
We shared selected information. We gave copies of this report to the photo safety people, and we'd be happy to give it to the traffic lieutenant as well. We share on a regular basis. When we go out and gather speed data, it's a real nice tool for them, because then they know when to go out and do their enforcement.
Yeah, it would seem that this should be a high priority for photo safety rather than some of the locations I see them setting. Just a personal comment.
Okay. Do you have the end of school signs up now at the schools? Have I just not seen them?
These signs are, those signs you see there are just at Rhodes, I believe, on Baseline.
Yeah, I believe there might be one other school where we've added the end school zone, but in the majority of cases, our practice has been just to put up the 45 mile per hour sign, and that's your cue that this is where the school zone ends. You don't need to have the end school zone sign to give that message. We did it at Rhodes because that was one of the suggestions we had from some of the parents, that it's hard for people to tell where that point is, so we added that sign.
So the flashers, though, are saying 35. So how do I know when I'm at the start of the school, at the middle zone? Hmm. What's at the end?
Pardon me?
What's at the end of the school zone when I can resume my speed? How do I know where that mark hmm. is so I don't get a ticket?
Yeah, it'll either be the end school zone sign or a 45 mile per hour static sign, the typical speed limit sign.
Okay, so you have repost one there.
We have two options, Mayor. We can either repost the 45, so as soon as you see that sign, that's where the 45 zone resumes, or you can post it specifically with a sign that says end school zone, so that's end of the 35, and then sometime thereafter they would encounter a 45 mile per hour sign. We space them out every quarter mile, so it's pretty clear to the driver. I think the best sign, though, is probably the end school zone that tells them when they're out of the zone.
Okay. Curiosity question. When you go through the 15-mile crosswalk things, it says 15, you slow down. Obviously, you're 15 at the crosswalk, there's nobody coming. When can you resume back to the 25 or 35 school zone speed?
Mayor, you're allowed to resume your speed as soon as you cross the second yellow line.
The crosswalk.
Correct.
Not the back side of the other sign pointing that direction.
That's correct.
All right. Thanks. I was hoping that was the case. All right. Scott.
Well, Dan, I have a question on method. When looking at the slide 8, the one-year evaluation, during this time frame, do you know if the police were concurrently running increased enforcement with photo radar?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, are you referring to the speeds taken on in front of roads?
Yeah, during your study, we have 7-8 mile an hour speed slowing down. Were the police also doing an stepped up enforcement for photo radar or not?
I'll let Renee handle that, but let me take a first crack at it. We coordinated pretty closely with them when they would be doing enforcement and when not, because we wanted to get a different sampling of speeds. As a matter of fact, we have more speeds than what we're showing on this chart. I think those were all under the same condition with just regular periodic enforcement. But we had some counts we took with especially heavy enforcement, and then we asked them actually to wait several weeks, and then we went out and took some more speeds. So, and they did vary a little bit, but generally this is typical
Yes.
Okay, so when speed, photo enforcement was going on, you held those speeds out of this model. So this accurately reflects just your efforts,
yes.
Not PD.
Yes.
That's what I want to know. Thank you.
Okay. You have a staff recommendation here with the reflective strips and the head plaques, placards, 17,550, yellow flashers at two schools, Fremont and Brimhall, approximately 40,000. In a one-year evaluation. I'm hearing some concurrence, I think, from council to proceed in that direction. Is there any objections to that? Okay, seeing none, appreciate the presentation. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Move forward. Item number three is, we are on three. Hear an update and discuss pandemic preparedness.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Gil Damiani, the emergency manager for the city. It's been a while since we've had an opportunity to discuss some emergency management issues. I've been asked to give a presentation on what we've done or efforts made towards pandemic preparedness. Although there may be other events that may cause a mass casualty, WMD, bioterrorism event, or even a chemical release that may affect a lot of people, some concerns here recently have been focusing on pandemics and what can be done. Before we get into actual pandemics, let me just give a brief overview on the flu in general. Obviously, it occurs annually. There are vaccines available that are usually manufactured that cover the three strains of flu from the previous year. The vulnerable populations typically are the very old, the very young, and then people that have immune deficiencies for whatever reason. On the pandemic side, they occur about every 30 to 40 years, the last one being the Hong Kong flu. The interesting point on that is the fact the vulnerable population was actually people from the age of 18 to 35, and for a variety of reasons. Mainly, there are people in the workforce around, and those are the people that were actually affected. As far as the immunity, because you don't know what that strain of virus will be, it's hard to predict or project what vaccine will work for that strain. The issue of recent concern is that of avian flu or bird flu. I don't claim to be an expert on pandemics or avian flu, but there is a lot of information, some of it contradictory, regarding some of the things on the flu. As far as the avian flu, it currently is out there. It has initially surfaced around 1996, so it's a little over 10 years old, and it is a something that's contracted from birds, obviously. And people that are getting it now, or have it, I should say, have got it from being in close contact with birds. One of the things that is of concern, recent concern, is the fact that it does have a very high attack rate. If you look at the attack rate for the seasonal flu, it occurs in about one out of five people. It's secreted, a spread through the same secretions and things like that. Typically, people don't die from the flu. They die of complications from it, pneumonia, and those types of things. We lose annually in the United States about 36,000 people to the flu. Now, we say approximately because, again, some of it may be reported as pneumonia, not necessarily related to the flu. Or due to the flu, but this is the way it's tracked. As far as on the avian side, the attack rate will be much higher, about one in three. It's usually spread through birds, And one of the concerns that they have, the medical experts have right now, is that it has not made the change from bird to human to human to human. So typically, people that get the avian flu now, or H5N1, are getting it from birds or in people that have been in close contact with those birds. And again, the death is usually caused by from the same complications. If we put this in terms of the city of Mesa, what could possibly occur? Again, seasonal flu 1 to 5 affect about 90,000 people. The death rate, I have a question mark there because I don't really know, but if I were to just use the population estimates, I would say probably in the city of Mesa we'd lose about 50 people every year due to the flu or complications from it. I don't have any evidence to actually prove that. Those are just population-based guesstimates. As far as the avian flu, attack rate is 1 in 3. Vulnerable population is almost 150,000 people. And this death rate is a little bit low. I'm guesstimating about 3,000, just under 3,000. But the actual death rate for the avian flu currently is about 50%. And that's, again, a lot of them are in third world countries. They don't have the medical care that we have. But if we did have a pandemic, the hospitals would be impacted significantly. So the death rate would probably be much higher than 3,000 people here in the city. So what are we doing? What's emergency management doing? Obviously, we are not the flu experts, but we do rely on the World Health Organization, the Center for Disease Control, and the Department of Health and Human Services to provide us information. And we are constantly monitoring to see what the trends are, where the virus is moving, and how it's moving throughout the world, not just the country or Arizona. We also realize that if we do have an event, we're not going to be in this by ourselves. We're going to be partnering with the state and county health departments. Closer to the city, we are working very closely with the Mesa Public Schools and obviously the healthcare system, because they will be impacted probably as well or probably even worse than we are. We do have several committees out there and task force that we work together with these different entities that provide us input, and we share information. Again, if we have an incident, it probably just won't affect Mesa. It will probably be something that is either a statewide, regional, or maybe even a national event that that we need to be prepared for and aware of. A couple of the things that we've done is to work on what they call a point of dispensing, or a pod, a point of distribution. In other words, if in fact the flu does occur, how do we get medication to the folks that need it? And one of the things that we've discussed with the county, and actually we've partnered with the schools and the county on using a point of distribution in the city of Mesa, and I'll get with that in a little bit, but basically it's getting medication to people quickly in a lot of different areas, or as quickly as we can using different means. Usually, a point of dispensing, the population is coming to us, so which means some people will be transient. Regarding the pod issue, obviously, if people are sick, they need to get medication. The cost of the flu vaccine or antiviral is the vaccine is about $20 a person, and the antiviral, depending on the state subsidies, could be between about $15 a person, roughly. The supply, the Center for Disease Control does have supply of antivirals that they would distribute throughout the country to wherever it's needed as quickly as possible. What we don't have is an adequate supply of flu vaccine, because we don't know what the strain of flu is to have the vaccine for. So these are some of the issues when it comes to points of dispensing and getting information out.
Scott has a question. Chief, on the cost of the flu vaccine, start adding that up, that's a lot of money. If we were to have a flu pandemic or an epidemic outbreak here in Mesa in the Valley, and the governor were to declare a state of emergency, would the state then take that fiscal burden off the cities? How is that payment going to be arranged?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, I'm sure you're well aware that the governor does have that authority to do that. However, if you think about the cost of the burden, the city of Mesa alone would be in the neighborhood of $1.5 million. If this were, in fact, a statewide emergency, it could be, well, it could be...
Well, if it were just confined to the East Valley, which is highly unlikely that that would happen, and she were to declare a state of emergency, and we would then get flu vaccine from the national stockpile?
Well,
would
again,
we be charged for that, or would the state incur those costs?
The state could do that. The governor does have that authority. However, when you think about a flu vaccine, it's got to be manufactured first. But if you're addressing just a cost issue, that can be arranged in that manner, yeah, through the governor or through the state, I should say.
I did the math at 480,000 people. It's 9.6 million. Okay. Mike?
Yeah, there was a lot of talk this year about the fact that there's a difficulty in finding companies that are willing to manufacture vaccine because of the high disposal rate. You know, they have to gear up for everybody, and everybody doesn't get it, so they end up throwing away. And it's not profitable for them to do that. Anything happening on the federal level to subsidize that you're aware of?
Mayor, Councilmember Whelan, I'm not aware of that, but that is a very good point, and there has been a point of interest in that area, and I don't know where it's at, but I can find out. Thank you. So again, the Center for Disease Control does have a stockpile of Tamiflu. Again, the flu vaccine would have to be manufactured. And again, there's usually a backlog or waiting time to get that manufactured in time. As I mentioned before, we do participate in these points of dispensing exercises. And we did one with the county asked us to do the first one in Maricopa County. So we did it at Westwood High School back in October, and it was a very successful exercise. A couple of the points that were of interest is that, what would we do if, in fact, there was a pandemic? We did have a stockpile of medicine, and folks were adamant about getting more than they were supposed to get, or more than there was allotted to them. So security of the medical cache was an issue. The training of the staff. Typically, the county wants volunteers to staff their points of dispensing, points of distribution. We realize that if you're getting mostly parents coming into the school that have never worked in an area like that, moving people, giving up medication, things like that, they didn't know what to do. And a lot of it, when you think about the organization of the event, that was an issue as well. And finally, the staffing reliability. If there were a pandemic, if you have identified 50 volunteers, there's a good chance that half of them won't show up for the event when you actually need them for that. So the county is working on that, and we are also trying to get folks that are interested in participating in these pods or being assigned to a pod if, in fact, we do have to administer some medication. Some of the things that we plan on doing as far as emergency management is concerned, we have 5 high schools in the city that we have not done pods at. We want to move forward with the Mesa Public Schools to do those exercises. We did have a point of dispensing or vaccine exercise that we had planned at our facility, at the public safety training facility, where we were going to do what we called drive-by shootings, people going by in their vehicles, and we would just administer through our paramedic staff vaccines.
Drive-by vaccinations, you mean?
Well, yes. We were calling them, yeah, drive-by vaccinations.
All right, thanks.
We do have, as a point of interest, 120 of our paramedics have been trained to give immunizations. So that is one thing that we have worked towards. The other thing is the federal government has a plan to distribute medication via the post office. If there is a pandemic, one of the things that we will be advocating people to do is to stay home and don't travel, don't go to malls, don't go to church, don't go to school, stay home and get medication through the post office. That plan hasn't been really worked out yet or exercised to my knowledge. And then finally, we want to stay current with the region, the county, and the other entities that are in the same boat we are as far as pandemic preparedness and working towards solutions. Other options, we want to make sure that we take every opportunity to educate the public on what they can do. As I mentioned earlier, stay home, keep a 96-hour supply of food and water. Mayor, you wrote an article back in January of 2003, I believe, and talked about this very same thing. And essentially, the message hasn't changed, except that we're advocating an extra day of supplies, medications, and things like that. We feel that that is really probably the best solution when it comes to a pandemic, getting the message out to the folks. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, the social distancing. Stay away from school. And again, we partner with the public schools because there's 84,000 school children out there. That's about 20% of the population of the city of Mesa. That is a lot of opportunity to transmit this virus if, in fact, it does take hold. So the schools would be a major portion of our plan. And again, we do work closely with them. From an emergency management perspective, we feel that it's our role to do what we can to keep city services moving in the event of a pandemic. So what we've tried to do is stockpile equipment using grant money from the major medical response system, grant fund that we get to provide different types of PPE and preventative tools such as alcohol, wipes, and things like that, hand cleaner, to keep the city moving so that we can provide the service that our citizens have become accustomed to.
Chief, on this slide, for the critical functions, have we actually conducted or developed a continuity of operations plan to specifically identify the critical functions and critical roles who's absolutely essential for services that must be delivered in 24 hours?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, I have that coming up, and we are working on a continuity of operation plan for the fire department, and I hope to eventually, and in the near future, spread that out to all the other city departments as well. But to date, we do not have the city does not have a continuity of operation plan.
And on those roles that are critical, can we determine which ones have the possibility of telecommuting? Because if they can stay home, like you said, stay away from school and everything else, if they could stay home and telecommute and do their job and achieve that critical function from home, then they're less apt to become ill.
That is one of the components of a continuity of operation plan, to identify who needs to be here and who can work from home. But
fire department, point. Paramedics, not so much.
That probably wouldn't work.
If you can figure that out, would you let me know?
Okay.
Right. Along those same lines, public safety workers are vitally important during any major incident. What type of plan do we have in place that they can be quarantined among themselves so that they don't have to worry about going home, or what can you do for families? Have you thought those things out also?
That is one of the components of the fire department continuity of operation plan, and I haven't finalized it yet. It's still in the draft stage, but that is one of the major concerns. Again, not infecting the families of the folks that have responded to some of these people that have been infected, to keep them somewhat quarantined so they can at least report to work. But that is an issue. That is a concern as well.
Virtually take a hotel or something and house public safety personnel there in the interim or something along those lines.
That it is working in that direction. We haven't identified a hotel yet, but or even a specific location, but that is one of the components of the plan.
And then you look at New Orleans, where public safety personnel were more concerned about their families, so they ended up going home. You've got that component too.
It's a very complicated issue, yes.
What do you anticipate to be the duration of an event that you would have to do this for?
Mayor, that's an excellent question as well. When you're thinking about a pandemic, or when you're concerned about a pandemic, it typically lasts. The initial wave may hit for a month, 6 weeks. It may break for 4 to 6 weeks, and then you'll get another wave. And the wave may hit two or three times. So we're looking at possibly 6 months.
Well, you're not going to stay home for 6 months. Isolate or not.
Again, with the data that we have now, or the data that's out there now, they expect each wave to get a little bit less. You know, in other words, it won't affect as many people every time it hits. But
okay, once there's some type of vaccination or they figure out what you can give to the body to fight it so you won't be infected, then I assume it's just how fast you can manufacture that, get it dispensed. Is that the
well, again,
trigger to stop the
In a pandemic situation, it's a little gray because we don't know what the strain will be. But the data that we do that is available out there does give some credibility to the antiviral that Tamiflu that's out there right now. Although it's not a for sure medication, that is something that does help. The workforce will be compromised to some degree, and we will have to figure out how that works. Each city department will have to figure out how best to utilize their staff, if that answers your question.
Yeah, and I think you've got a lot of paramedics that aren't going to be responding to calls, to that type of call at least.
Well, the other thing is we would probably triage the call.
Right.
Again, we'd advocate that people stay home. There may be on the healthcare side, urgent care centers may be the point of collection for people with the flu. We may identify a simple location or a single location for people that have flu-like symptoms.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Scott, you have?
Again,
Chief, you can
sorry.
Activate the MMRS as well and put up aid stations.
That is an option. That is certainly an option to do that, activate the MMRS system. However, it's not really geared for pandemics. It's more geared towards mass casualty types of activities, but that is certainly an option.
But at least the aid station component of that and having MMRS staff that
sure.
would be
That is certainly an option. And we are an MMRS city and several here in the county or in our region.
Who's the overseeing body for, say, Maricopa County, if it's multi-jurisdictional?
In the event of a pandemic?
What's the coordination? How does the city manager, the city council, the mayor enter into the decision-making to activate, to purchase supplies? Who does the overall, what's the governor do? What's the level of going up the chain here if this thing really escalates?
Mayor, right now, the way I would envision this to occur is that the Maricopa County, the Division of Health Services, would be the voice to the governor regarding advice and determining when a declaration of disaster would occur. The governor could then go to the local governing bodies to activate declarations of disaster as well in the local communities. At that point, we would assume to contact the Center for Disease Control for medication if that's what we need to do.
Okay. All
right. Anyway, this is the equipment that we have purchased, stockpiled, that we have currently with the city of within the city of Mesa that we use grant money to purchase, just essentially PPE to keep people from getting these viruses within them, hand cleaner, bio bags, and things like that to keep our folks protected. Again, keeping city services going. A couple of things that we are working on and some of the things we're going to work on is to, we just completed the employee survey. We had an online employee survey asking input from the city employees to provide us with, you know, how many of them come in contact with the public, how many of them handle food, how many of them get flu shots and things like that. So I just got this information on Monday, so I haven't had a chance to completely digest it, but we do have some information. One interesting point I thought was that about 50% of the people that responded get a flu shot, city employees. And I would assume it would be a little higher than that, but at this point, the number of respondents was about 50%. Again, Councilmember Summers mentioned that continuity of operation plan. It is something that is on the top of my list, or close to the top of my list, and it's something that we do need to work on, although it's as you can imagine, just some of the questions that were presented here, it's a complicated issue. It is going to require some time to get that complete. Educate the city departments and other folks, the citizens as well, regarding flu preparedness, what they can do. Keep our city website updated. And the other issue is there's been some interest within the hospitals and us to develop what they call a ethical triage within the community. In other words, who members in the community feel should get treated in the event of a pandemic. Typically, we treat people that are most susceptible, which are the very young and the very old. Is that the best way to do it? And again, this is just a concern right now, or something that we'd like to look at, but we haven't really moved forward on that. That's my presentation. Any questions?
So if I'm watching this on Channel 11 and I'm at home and there's a notification that it's now being transmitted from person to person instead of bird to person, and it's coming our way, what should someone in Mesa expect? That we would have a pod of service or shots, or how would we get that message out? Would we use reverse 911 and call? Obviously the papers would probably have something. What's your...
Mayor, the way this would most likely come down is if I get information from Maricopa County or the state saying that there is a pandemic, we could use the local emergency alert system that would put the little strip across the cable television to advise people to turn to Channel 11. We can give them more specific information regarding what they were actually dealing with. We could also use the SENS, the reverse 911, to share information with the public, as well as information on the radio. And again, if this were in fact an emergency that affected the state or even part of the country, I'm expecting to have pre-notification. So this would probably be coming, and I would advise people to make sure that they have a 96-hour supply of everything that they need. And again, if it is truly this flu or avian pandemic, they need to stay home. They need to prevent the spread by staying isolated. I won't say quarantine, I just say isolated. And that would most likely be the initial response in a pandemic situation.
Okay, so if there was a liquid vaccine that was created, it may even be dispensed through the post office as one. So they would actually deliver to the post office boxes or the houses, and is that one of the concepts too?
Mayor, on a vaccine, you'd have to administer that. You wouldn't be able to...
Shot.
They would probably have to come to a point of dispensing for the vaccine. If it's an antiviral like the Tamiflu, something they can take orally, that can be distributed through the mail, or that can be distributed through a pod as well. But again, if it is a flu situation or a pandemic situation, we're going to advocate that people stay home.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Move from birds to mosquitoes. Let's talk about the West Nile virus. Fight the bite. Huh?
Mayor, Council, I'm Scott Boucher, Environmental Programs Administrator, and it's my pleasure today to introduce Julie Stromopoulos and John Townsend with Maricopa County, and they're here today to provide you some information on their West Nile virus program.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Just in comment, I'm Relations Director for Regional Development Services Agency in Maricopa County, and that encompasses 9 departments. Emergency management is one of those departments. So the previous discussion is near and dear to my heart, and we run particular drills this week. This week in particular, on Tuesday morning, we ran an emergency flood scenario drill in which the City of Mesa's utility departments were involved in that. In terms of the message to the people at home that may be watching this morning, 3 days food and water, and then we always recommend that an established plan of contact for in-state and then out-of-state residents, that everybody have that as a minimum. We have also developed in Public Works in particular a continuity plan which identifies critical services and identifies necessary cross-training needs that we may have presently, so we are able to deliver those services in the event of a loss of workforce, and we have established trigger points, of course, when we would enact those certain things. So I would offer first and foremost to the people who were here that our Department of Emergency Management would love to assist in anything that Mesa may need in the development of a pandemic response plan, which the county has too. That being said, like to talk to you a little bit about Fight the Bite. We are in our fourth West Nile season out here in the valley. Today, just briefly, I'm going to go over a little bit about the virus itself, The vector involved, of course, is mosquitoes. Our integrated pest management system, personal protection, our countywide numbers from the previous year, and then specific numbers to the city of Mesa. The virus itself is spread by, there are different species of mosquitoes. Let me talk about the virus. I told you I was going to do that. West Nile virus, for 80% of the population that contracts the virus, it is asymptomatic, meaning that they will have probably no knowledge at all that they have contracted that, or a headache for an afternoon, and that's the extent of it. For about 20% of the population, they are susceptible to what's known as West Nile virus fever. And that is an illness similar to the flu that can last up to six weeks. And the CDC has done preliminary economic losses associated with that type of illness, and it's approximately $26,000 per case. I suspect that that number is fairly low. And then for less than 1% of the population, West Nile virus meningoencephalitis is a result, and that usually is characterized by paralysis and even death, loss of life. And similar to the flu, our young, our elderly, and anybody with a compromised immune system is particularly susceptible to that. The mosquitoes are the vector of this particular disease, and we deal with primarily three different types. Culex species are the primary vector. They are most likely to carry the virus during peak season. Floodwater mosquitoes can carry the virus. They're the ones that come out in thousands and thousands and thousands from irrigated pieces of property. They are less likely to carry it, but the potential is there. And then we have a new species, the Aedes aegypti, which has arrived in the valley, and I'll let John speak to that in a few minutes. Our integrated pest management system in the county, we've been at this 4 years now, and we are starting to seriously refine it, and we've achieved quite a few efficiencies. We have a three-prong approach: education, surveillance, and mitigation. First few years, our emphasis was a lot on education as we ramped up our surveillance activities. The thrust of our program now, of course, is surveillance. Mitigation, when I speak of mitigation, that's usually the adult mosquito population, and I'm talking about adulticiding, or what's commonly referred to as fogging. In terms of education, we put out the message of property maintenance. A large portion of your mosquito populations are actually going to be originate in the backyard, in the average backyard, not necessarily in off-site places, but they will be backyard nuisances that are created. So we encourage people to do what we call the West Nile walk after storm events. As little as 4 ounces of water, if left to stagnate, can actually bloom thousands of mosquitoes. So it's important that residents walk their property after storm events, and that takes less than 72 hours to bloom. Personal protection. Dusk and the dawn are particular for certain types of species to bite. We recommend people use personal protection in terms of covering themselves in long sleeves in those hours, and the use of repellent. Media relations we continue to do. It's getting a little more difficult each year to get the message out there. Unfortunately, there seems to be an idea that if you were going to contract West Nile virus, you would have done so in the last 4 years, and that's simply not the case. So we are in the process of doing a survey in conjunction with public health in terms of behaviors, so we can tighten our messaging out to the public. But what we're finding is that people are less and less concerned about it, which is unfortunate. Intergovernmental cooperation, that includes me visiting various councils. That's 4 years ago, our Board of Supervisors brought in various agencies from the cities, invited them in to ensure that we were communicating both on staff level as well as leadership levels to make sure that we were able to address this problem. And then private sector relations, I do those as well. Surveillance activity is where our thrust is. We have 40 staff members, FTEs, that perform this service year-round. I would say 90% to 95% of what they do is focused purely on mosquito, stagnant water, and green pools. I know you get a little roof rat action in there on occasion, don't you, John?
A little bit.
Okay, so that would be the balance of what he deals with in a year. routine site inspections. We have thousands of them on file. We try to get to them once a month, make sure that they are either not breeding or to treat them for such, and that's what the larva sampling you see here indicates. We still do equine surveillance in conjunction with regional veterinary associations. We still accept dead bird surveillance, but I'll be real honest with you. We had sentinel chicken flocks the previous years, and what we found was is that we were getting more rapid information from our traps, the carbon dioxide traps here that you see. So the chickens weren't giving us advance warning on virus activities in particular areas, so we have dispensed with that. This is a carbon dioxide trap. How it works is it puts out, we set the trap with dry ice. It puts out carbon dioxide, which mocks the breath of mammals, and it attracts mosquitoes. When they go in there, they get caught in a fan mechanism, which drops down into the net. It's picked up the following morning, and a number of things are done with that. We take that sample into the lab. We determine species in each of those traps, because some species are more apt to carry West Nile than others. We test it, what's known as a ramp test. That's our field test. That gives us some type of putative response in terms of whether it's a positive or a negative. We also count those species. And the reason I mention that is that it's real important. Under the fogging triggers, we have a protocol that was approved by the Board of Supervisors. When we receive a trap that has over 300 floodwater mosquitoes or over 30 Culex species mosquitoes, or any size sample which has a West Nile positive ramp test will trigger an adult deciding activity. But our thrust is to prevent those blooms from occurring. So our focus is definitely on surveillance and prevention. Let me give you some countywide numbers for last year. 75 confirmed human cases with 6 deaths. We took in over 14,000 complaints. Our peak week, I believe, was in July. We fielded over 1,400 calls, complaint calls. We had 2,762 routine site inspections, or sites that we have that we routinely inspect, I should say, and over almost 5,000 green pools that we investigated. An important message that I can send to you is that we are not the green pool police per se. We definitely want to know about green pools to make sure that they are treated and that they are not breeding. However, we need to let neighbors know, especially those who are submitting the complaints, that that doesn't necessarily mean that the pool is going to turn blue. We are there to treat it for the breeding mosquitoes. Often we do that with gambusia fish. So as much as we'd like to assist with the aesthetics, a lot of people are concerned that we haven't treated pools when in fact we have, either through larvaciding or through the gambusia fish population.
Fish in the pools?
We put fish in the pools.
Doesn't the chlorine just kill them? Or there's not a chlorine left in there?
No chlorine left.
It's already out of acid. Okay. That's
what. Well, the fish also provide, assuming that there is enough water in the pool, the fish will also reproduce until such time as that particular source of stagnant water goes dry. So it gives you, the larvicide usually has a limited amount of time that it may remain, 150 days that it may remain.
These real small fish?
They're about minnow size, about an inch long.
So when they turn the pool filter back on? Okay, all right, go ahead.
I'm not going to answer that in case anybody from PETA may be watching this morning.
Okay.
Weekly, we had last year 371 routine traps set across Maricopa County. We would go out and put, that's our routine samples of traps that are scattered across the urban area. We also would site traps based on complaints. We are actually shifting that this year. John and his crew have upped it, and by in the next few weeks, I think we're going to have over 500. So when we get complaints, they'll be in regular locations. When we get complaints, we will be able to correlate that complaint most likely to a nearby existing trap, and then correlate the number of complaints around that area. So we do monitor that anyways, but it will help us in determining what type of problem or other sources we may have in the area that are feeding that. So we are saving that, we're shifting our efficiency towards the mobilization to our routine site inspections, the storm drains, the culverts that you have, the other areas. And we had 102 West Nile virus positive samples last year in Maricopa County. To date, we have had one positive within the state, that was in Clarkdale. In the city of Mesa, the breakdown last year, over 1,700 complaints, 684 sites that we routinely inspected, 629 pools.
Each one of those site inspections are monthly, too.
Oh, each of the site inspections are done monthly. Thank you. Right. 26 routine traps are set on a weekly basis. A lot of those are located at your fire departments. And we had 14 West Nile positive mosquito samples that peaked in September with 10 within your jurisdiction. That peak is not unusual. Don't expect it to follow that pattern every year. It is very susceptible to weather events. Our complaints and the special trappings that are done are also very subject to media releases. Mesa traps by location here, the red dots indicate a routine site, and the blue dots indicated special trappings based on complaints received to our department. Adults siding, the fogging in MAP, or for Mesa in 2006, the red section is a hot section. We have about three of those in the valley currently. That was fogged a minimum of six times. The others in the lighter colors, one to five. So we do have specific areas, and those actually...
Where is that red grid?
Those maps, I believe, were passed out. Were they
not? It's too small for me to read.
It's between Southern and Broadway, Val Vista, and... 1 mile to the east, Greenfield.
You and I.
Mostly. Mesa trapping for this year, what you see here in red are the routine trap sites. The blues are the ones that have been placed based on complaints year to date. With that, I would refer city residents to the county website, which is located on the screen there, or to contact us at 602-506-0700 to report a complaint, ask questions about West Nile, or any other issue that we can assist them with.
Okay, Mike.
Backup water on the east side of Tempe Town Lake. What do we have down there? Is that a potential breeding ground all the time?
Yes. Yes. We have several routine traps in that area, about seven of them that get sampled every single week. We're trying to work with the Indian community, City of Tempe, City of Mesa, there's multi-jurisdiction down there, to alleviate that problem. Tempe was doing some pumping of the water, which has actually kind of made more problems here and there because it pulls the water down and leaves more pockets of smaller pockets that maybe have less fish in them than a large body of water that has lots of fish. So it's an ongoing process down there.
Is that water stagnant or is it moving? I know the underground river is still running, but...
It's a little of both.
It continues to perk through the gravel and the cobble. It's just that there's more input than output.
What we have at that particular, I'm sorry.
Councilmember Whelan, there's continual flows into there from, there's a dual stormwater channel that is Tempe flows, Mesa flows, ADOT flows, that there's several million gallons going in there every day that are just nuisance flows that are non-stormwater discharges that are collecting from throughout the East Valley that discharge there.
Mayor, Councilmember Whelan, we actually, the outfall for the eastern portion of the urbanized freeway system actually puts up to, the capacity is up to 10 million gallons a day into that particular area. You also have upstream activity. You do have the percolation that's occurring there. And then, of course, the Tempe Town Lake changed the dynamics of that. They have installed a pump in which, a bypass pump, in which I think they're moving up to 3 million gallons a day. So what we see there is, generally speaking, when there's a lot of water or no water, we don't have an issue. It's when there are changing waters and small marshes in that area. We did hold a joint meeting a couple years ago, and it was more a meeting of discovery to see who owned what, who was doing what in that area, and what we could do about it. Both flood control and vector control work with the Native American community there to get in, set the traps, and to fog it. Part of the problem is that the reach of a delta sighting in that area, generally a delta sighting is done, it is done by vehicles. To get it into some of those other areas where the water is up and down, it is quite difficult, and it brings up a number of other ecological issues.
One other thing, Mayor. Concerns from some people when their neighborhood is fogged as to can they be outside. Can you talk about the harm or the concern for a neighborhood if they're scheduled for fogging?
Sure. We have... We have a notification list if anybody wants to be notified prior to us treating an area. And what we'll do is if we've got that square mile area scheduled for fogging, they'll get a call usually 24 to 48 hours in advance, letting them know that we're going to be there. All of our fogging occurs at nighttime, usually between the hours, 10 o'clock's the absolute earliest, and that would be mostly in rural areas. For municipal areas, it's usually after midnight, between midnight and 5 o'clock in the morning. And the material is ultra low volume. It's actually put out at 0.2 ounce per acre. So it's basically a mist, and it degrades very, very quickly after sunlight hits it. So usually within a few hours of the sunlight, of the sun coming up, the material's dissipated. So, they're all EPA approved and applied through those methods. So, that's about the best thing we can do is just to notify them, to let them know that we're going to be in that area.
If residents want to be notified of that, going to the website, they can subscribe to that notification. And what happens is this phone call will trigger whatever phone number they sign up with it. Phone call will be issued, and they will be told that fogging will be occurring in their mile section neighborhood.
I know we get email alerts.
Yes.
We just wonder if that could somehow be scrolled on Channel 11 also as to the area. Can we do that just so people are aware?
It's currently listed on our website, but we can work with the Channel 11 folks and see about getting that posted on Channel 11 when we receive the notifications.
Thank you. And Mayor and Council, speaking of that, we've had a problem. We've recently shifted our website over to the public health website, and then they're housing it on their server. Our notification used to come out 36 to 72 hours in advance when the fogging was scheduled. And I have been working with that staff, and in the meantime, to make sure that that happens again. Right now, they're getting at midnight of the day it's scheduling, the computer sending those out. We are working on that problem. I'd like to thank your environmental staff who have been very helpful in dealing with problem sites that we have identified in Mesa. Last year, we did give them a whole list of the routine sites that we know of within your city. But we will also include them directly from our lab on the email list until we have that computer glitch rectified. So.
Okay, I appreciate your time and thanks for coming over.
Thank you.
Item number 5 is acknowledging receipt of minutes of various boards and committees. We have 4. A motion, second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes. The reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Any updates? Kyle.
Yesterday I did a site visit with Deb Duvall, our in school, and Lynn Burnham, school board. We visited Kerr Elementary, where we learned about the Experience Corps, where you have older individuals that are experienced go into the classroom and help. It's more of a volunteer service. And it was very good and very effective, and they're hoping to expand that so they, wherever possible, put in plugs for people who are looking for something to do. The schools could definitely use them.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. Scheduling of meetings and general information, Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. A reminder that we do have our council meeting on Monday, the 21st. We will be anticipating starting that discussion, the study session for that meeting at 4:30. We'll be reviewing the having the transit discussion and direction from council during that part of the study session. Then we will have our two remaining study sessions for May on the 24th and 31st. And just a reminder, for June, our council meetings are just a little different. At least the second one is, we'll have a council meeting on June 4th, but the second council meeting will not be till June 25th. And that's just related to the budget, providing the notice and then approval of the budget before July. So, thank you, Mayor.
Okay. Do we have any requests to speak this morning?
We have none, Mayor.
Okay. Then the study session is adjourned, but I do need to call a special council meeting to order for the purposes of convening an executive session. All right, do I have a motion? Sorry. I have a motion and second to enter a new executive session. Tom.
Mayor, on item number one, or number 2A, which is the salaries of public officers, I'm not quite sure why that has to be an executive session. We're not doing a critique of the individuals. We're assessing market forces and trying to bring those within the same thing we did with the discussions that we had 2 weeks ago with all city employees. So I'm not sure that it might technically qualify, but I don't think it's necessary or appropriate to have this discussion in executive session.
Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, you're correct. It does qualify under the open meeting law. It specifically says for to discuss salaries, and because the judges are council appointed, you can discuss this in executive session. You're not required to. You can also discuss it in public if council chooses to.
I didn't know what we were doing until I read their backup, and the backup is all market oriented, and to me that's not something that needs to occur in secret. So that's my only comment. I'll attend if that's the will of the group, but
I think the pattern on compensation, and I think there's also some discussion then, I would assume that not only on compensation and comparing, but also on evaluation of, or is that not posted for that? Is it only compensation?
No, Mayor, it's only compensation because of the judges are on two-year appointments, or some are on four-year appointments, depending on where they are in the step. You consider their evaluation and their performance when they are up for reappointment. At this point, it is just a salary recommendation or request.
Right, because I know when we were entering into employment contracts, city manager, other people, we did do those in private. But if they come up for, and I guess you can do your evaluations in private, but if you're doing just a compensation to match others mid-cycle, is that where you're coming from, Tom?
Yeah, my point is, as I read the backup and I read the agenda item, we weren't doing any job performance evaluation criteria. We're simply saying, should these numbers be adjusted because the market dictates it, and these salaries, once they're made, I mean, they're public notice once we establish them, so it's not like they're secrets later. So I just question the efficacy and quasi need for an executive session.
And we can certainly bring it back posted for a study session agenda in a public meeting if that's the council's desire.
I concur. I was thinking that because we had done, but it's usually in concurrence with hiring or something else. So if that's the case, and you're absolutely right, I see no reason to not put that on a study session item, and we'll go through it that way. So let's take that one off.
For the executive
Okay. All right, we have a motion and second to go into executive session. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right.